Clean Water Commission meeting to order at 6:35. So we have the minutes from the last meeting. Has everyone had an opportunity to review them?
I have a correction. Back on page 3, where it lists membership in each of the work groups, I'm on the partnership group,
okay.
And I'm not listed there, and I'm not on the outreach education group, and I am listed there.
Okay, we will fix that.
I didn't want to be on all three work groups.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, you are. So you're saying you want to be on research and partnership?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Christy, did you want to go back on to outreach since there's
I think
only two people on it?
I'm happy to do whatever works best. If that's where you need me, I can do that.
We can keep Christy on research. I think that's where her interest lies.
That's fine. Yeah.
I just you had mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, we're fine.
One thing, it would be helpful to number the pages for the minutes, just as we were doing the corrections.
I think there's go on. One more correction was Commissioner Seeds can't attend. David was one unable to connect, right?
No.
Since he was abroad.
We didn't even try.
Oh, okay. I thought that he had asked us to.
We didn't have a phone that would be able
to. Gotcha. Okay, that was the problem.
I had to.
Never
been
hard connected. Too far away.
Yeah,
I never actually get him to email me back to Court Institute.
I had a couple of corrections also.
Okay.
Yeah, there was actually some kind of phone network issue that day. So I made a number of phone calls that just wouldn't connect through, like the Portland Fire Bureau department to ask about firefighting phone and some other stuff. And the next day, all those same numbers worked fine, so there was just some sort of network
the snow
issue. I just was not supposed to communicate, I guess. not early.
Oh, can I go find the page? So where you had iPad, you had I small with a hyphen PAD, and I believe it's capital I PAD, and it's in there twice. Now I'm trying. Oh, okay, on page 2. Second paragraph. There's the first one. And then you also mentioned WSDOT, and that's actually the abbreviation is WSDOT, is the official. And that is in here somewhere.
On the top.
Oh, 4. 1, 2. Under outreach. 1, 2, 3. On 4, with the NACA group. And then I had another one on page 5 for the annual report. Talking about the presentation, if he could just say thanks to Alice for updating the report to a very professional style and just delete the old blue raindrop graphic and that stuff. Just kind of condense that.
And on top of page 5, the first bullet. Third line, Dean explained the context is related to various funding relationships. In addition, Clark County is in compliance with the Growth Management Act, isn't allowed to apply for certain grants. So the question was about the removal of partnerships as a part of the selection process. And so is it just being related to various funding relationships and Clark County not being able to get funding? Is that? I think that's what was meant there.
I think the A is supposed to be eliminated from before funding, because it's the way he explained it, and I listened to it twice, was that there's obviously two things going on there. One is the partnerships being eliminated was due to being related as being part of funding relationships, was how it was being in the context of that section. But then the secondary aspect of it was the Growth Management Act and not being allowed to apply right now, being out of funds.
Okay.
Any other amendments?
Obviously, we read the minutes.
I'm gonna have Amanda. Yeah, I was like, well, maybe I'll have Andrea go back. No, it's all good. I'm glad you read them. Thank you.
I'll throw them on the fifth page in the bullet about the Chilachi Prairie Railroad comment letter. See, Dean will discuss with the Development Engineering Advisory Board straight period regarding the gap. So there's a period that.
It originally was deep, and then we.
Yeah.
Okay, so no period.
Yeah, I live here, so obviously I can't correct you right off the steps. I mean, I can, but it wasn't really a good correction.
Okay.
Make a motion to approve the minutes as amended.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay. It has been moved and seconded to approve the minutes at the minutes as approved. You notice I have a little script now that I'm trying to follow so I don't mess up, which I forgot all about roll call because I'm so into doing the minutes here. Let's go ahead and do roll call. Brendan?
Here.
Christy?
Here.
Michelle Gertz?
Here.
David McDivitt? Not here. Sue Marshall?
Here.
Justin Maynard? Not here. Michelle Maynard?
Here.
Josh Sheets?
Here.
Okay. All right. So we will open up to public comment.
Actually, we need to approve your minutes.
I thought we did.
Let's do it all in favor.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Live motion.
Okay. See, I'm learning.
I know, sorry.
That's fine.
If you hadn't, I would have.
Okay.
So we have a motion and then a second. So
okay.
Vote on it.
Has been moved and seconded to approve the minutes. I thought we all. Oh, you have to vote. Okay.
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All in opposed? Okay, the motion is approved. So let's go back to our public comments. Is anyone in the audience would like to speak? No? Okay. All right. We're going to jump over to Eric because he has to leave, and then we'll have Ben go after him.
Okay. We've been busy in outreach in April. It's our busy month. Started off with Friends of Trees with planting on April 9th. We planted 121 trees, which is more than we've ever planted at one of those events. Actually, 117 new trees because four of them were replacement trees. Some other events we had in April, the Klein Line Kids Fishing Derby, which Marie Kane helped out with, and so did Alice. And on that same day was the WSU Extension Small Acreage Expo. I gave a presentation there to an audience of a dozen or so. And then the following week was Clark Public Utilities Earth Day Fest over in between the softball fields and Climb My Pond at Santa Cruz Greenway. Thank you very much to everybody who helped out, including who else was there?
That day was just the two of us.
Just the two of us, the whole time, wasn't it? Well, just the two of us. So thank you so much.
That's why we can't remember.
Weekend after weekend after weekend. But that was a lot of fun. Let's see, for Don't Drive and Drive, we've got the brochure and a website translated and published in Spanish, which is good. So I also got some Spanish phrases translated. So hopefully try to use some of those in some social media outreach and efforts. And fortunately, in Public Works, we have a receptionist that works on the fourth floor, Cindy Gonzalez, who's very helpful. She also speaks Spanish, too. So I ran it by her. If I get a comment back in a social media post, I'm going to have to ask her. So. she's really helpful in that regard. We've got about 8 events, I think, scheduled for the Watershed Alliance this year for the Leak Check events. We've really been crushing our goals in the digital marketing deliverables with some different Google advertising, Google display ads. We've been really happy with those. And so, yeah, things are chugging along with that. The other two grants that we have, the stormwater facilities materials, we've just finalized both of those contracts in the past month. They're all signed and ready to go, and we are also gearing up to hold the focus group for the stormwater facilities materials. And so we'll have a focus group of HOA residents who are likely to be responsible for maintaining their stormwater facilities, and then we'll have a second focus group for landscapers and contractors who are performing maintenance in stormwater facilities in Clark County. So I've drafted those questions and stated some of our goals, sent them off to the partners, and I'm waiting to hear back. They're supposed to have their edits back by Friday, and then a meeting with Riley Associates, who is a focused research, market research group that we've contracted with, next Wednesday to see if I can clarify anything and answer any questions. Give them some guidance for doing this focus group. We're really excited about that. To go along with that, we also, Andrea, Logue, and I went to Municon last week on Thursday and Friday. And Municon it's like a municipal, actually it's Wednesday and Thursday, municipal stormwater conference in Washington State. So it happens every other year. And that was up in SeaTac. And they had an education outreach track on the main conference day, and the day before they had a social marketing workshop, basically, which were incredibly helpful. Both were really helpful in getting me thinking about the right approach to take with developing these materials, and both in giving me some ideas, but also, you know, reaffirming that the approach that we're taking was the right one. And so, we're really excited to move forward with that. Municon was really helpful to go to just to connect with other folks and see what other people are doing. I'll tell you, some of those other jurisdictions bring a lot of people, so they must be either close or really well-funded or both. I was amazed. It was a great experience. I think I'd encourage, I think people can check it out even if you're a nonprofit or just an interested citizen.
The focus group, that will inform materials you'll develop related to the private stormwater facilities?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, having all that information, you know, kind of vetted and, you know, we have an idea of what we think is going to work, but it's also important to kind of give that proposal and maybe there's a better way or there's some feedback that they can give to be an insightful improvement that maybe we didn't see. It's tough sometimes when you're in the thick of it to really get a clear picture of it from the outside, and that's kind of the goal there. Yeah. And then with the Watershed Signs project, you know, a big part of that is creating a countywide watershed map using Esri story maps. And so our GIS team has been great. They really keep making great impressions on me with just how well their staff works with other divisions and other departments and just how knowledgeable and helpful they are. And so they actually set up We met with them a couple weeks ago to discuss the next steps with the story map, and they ended up saying, okay, we'll set up a training for public, some public works folks, because they are really trying to push the story maps with some effective communication tools throughout the county. And so yesterday and tomorrow I'll be attending the second part of the workshop to learn a little bit more about story maps. I don't know if you've worked with them, but I don't have really much GIS experience. So to me, you know, they're telling us, like, well, you know, compared to ArcGIS, it's kind of not all the options that you have. And to me, I'm just like, you can do all that? And, like, it's just a story map. So, yeah, it's really excited about moving forward with that and getting their help and really developing something awesome. It'll be a great educational resource tool for everybody.
But what is a story map? How would you describe a story map?
Yeah, so a story map is it's basically a very user-friendly way to communicate GIS and spatial data on a website or on a mobile device. And so, you know, if you can, like, scroll through a sidebar and the maps will change as you get to different sections, or maybe you'll have a map with, like, a descriptive sidebar and some tabs across the top, and if you click on different tabs, the map will move around and show different kinds of data. You can also show videos. You can show a website within a story map. You can show all sorts of different images. So it's really rich media experience.
And so you can do a before and after kinds of comparisons.
Yeah, you can do before and after. They have this one feature that has, like, a picture, and you can, like, slide a bar back and forth to actually see, like, a map, like, you know, development from 1960 to today, like, you know, what it looks like. It's amazing. It seems like, you know, the possibilities are endless. So I think the hardest part is going to be winnowing down, you know, what's the most important part and what we really want to know. And hopefully, to be honest, in the focus group, we might even kind of, I think some of the questions that we ask in the focus group will also be able to help inform the story map. You know, if we can find some questions that can serve both purposes, we'll definitely want to include those. So, you know, specifically about languages and kind of an understanding about what watersheds are to know where to start. So it'll be really helpful. Let me see what else. A couple weeks ago I presented at a watershed stewards class. And this is the watershed steward being put on by the Clark Conservation District. They're holding it at the new Fish and Wildlife Building out in Ridgefield, which is a really nice facility. And I was the first speaker there, just kind of covering the watersheds in Clark County. And Nikki Yeo from the city presented on surface and groundwater. And then Terry Hebert, who I only know her name, I don't think I've met her. She presented on, I think, native plants and wildlife, no, just maybe native plants, just on Monday of this week. And so I'll be coming again to finish up the final class, kind of helping to recap and also making sure that the new stewards are aware of all of the volunteer opportunities, because, you know, it's one of those learn and serve programs, and so they're expected to give back, I think, 8 hours in the next year of watershed service. So seems like a very enthusiastic group, and they had a lot of good questions and really engaged. So that was a fun thing to do. The East Fork Lewis River TMDL group, they're going to be having an open house on June 3rd at the La Center Grange. Is June 3rd a Monday?
The first is a Friday.
First of the Friday.
It's a Monday, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's what it is then. That's going to be at the La Center Grange. It's kind of like a town hall meeting format, I think. So we're still working out the exact format with Department of Ecology. Some other organizations, like the Small Acreage Program, and some other groups are going to be there just to kind of share with residents some of the things that they're doing and some of the resources that are available to them to help with different things.
What day was the TPL work group meeting?
The work group meeting? I don't know when the next work group meeting, but that town hall.
The town hall.
Is June 3rd. Okay. It's Monday at the La Center Grange.
they have a local advisor.
Yeah, they do have a committee, a group of kind of stakeholders that they bring together. They brought together a few.
But you don't know when that meeting is.
No, I don't. But Alice, if you want to remind me, I'll get back to.
And the county has a seat at the table on that advisory committee. Correct.
Yeah, I think at this point it's not, you know, I'm not exactly sure how it's structured right now. It's been more informal meeting where they've just been kind of inviting partners. And so they brought, I've been to a meeting where they brought a broad base of people, you know, from residents to, you know, different nonprofits and different agencies that are working in the East Fork. They've kind of given a presentation on some of the different efforts that we've been monitoring, results that they've found from some of their research.
Okay.
And I think that's it.
So it sounds like it's pretty early in the process as yet.
Yeah, it's fairly early in the process. I think the first one might have been about 5 months ago or so. But yeah, I think they're still developing. And they've been trying to get the outreach out. I know they've done some individual mailers to people along the East Fork Lewis River in some communities. And so they're doing their best to get the word out and share that stuff coming down the pipeline for that too.
I think there has been a good deal of study in identifying what the problems are, and now they're kind of in phase two. Engage the community.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you know, they're looking at people and temperature kind of big ones. So those are the major impairments that we're looking at. So seeing what their resources are and who's in to help and who can be folks into wanting to help.
Seems like an area of should be an area of active interest for Clean Water.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about, you know, the permit, stormwater permit is a driver, but it seems like the TMDLs would be equally important as a driver.
I was just going to say, as part of our partnership, I met with Devin Rostetler, who's the water quality specialist and is leading the TMDL. So I'll write up my notes. I haven't done it yet. I want to send them to her first before I send them out to people, so I make sure I've got things right. But
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of potential there for
there is.
To collaborate.
It's nice when we kind of understand that there's a larger effort somewhere, and we can, you know, one thing that we have done, you know, when I was drafting the scope of work for the small acreage program this year, like last year I had them, when we were doing the Whipple Creek Watershed Plan, made sure that put in a few specifics, like we want you to have a well and septic workshop within the Whipple Creek Watershed, we want you to hold a BMP workshop within the Whipple Creek Watershed. So we did that again in the East Fork now this year to really try to bring some of those services to the watershed that we're targeting and kind of focusing on.
Next on the on Devin's agenda will be moving to Burnbridge Creek and then to Lacamas above the lake, but that's going to start moving several years out. And, so those are the areas to maybe look at.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice job. Oh, I have one question for you. Any update on the backyard wildlife program? And how that's going?
Yeah, no,
involved with that?
I don't have a good update for that right now. We're still trying to figure out how to give some support financially. We have like a new financial system, and it's a little bit more challenging work day.
Okay.
For some people.
I met with Columbia Land Trust today, and they're really excited about what can be accomplished through that program. I see it as an area of a possible partnership with Clark County, a significant area. So, you know, whether it's funding or what that looks like,
yeah,
I think think there's an opportunity there. So.
Well, I know that the SWEO group, Solid Waste Education Outreach or Environmental Outreach, they are giving some funding this year, and Clean Water plans to give some funding this year and the next year, and kind of as a pilot, and you know, look further into it as we see it goes these first couple of years. But yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for it too.
And would Columbia Land Trust administer that backyard habitat filter?
It will actually be the Watershed Alliance, but they also get a lot of support from the Columbia Land Trust, okay, and also a lot of support from
Audubon.
The Alberta Audubon Society. Yeah.
Thanks.
Your scion survived?
What's that?
Your scion survived?
3 out of 4. And 1 out of 2 grapes.
There you go.
And this, for our continuing on our education of clean water, today we have Ben Joner from Clean Water. He, in the monitoring group, he's our natural resources specialist.
It's abbreviated. So, or just NRS works too.
So, and so he's going to.
Yeah. Ready?
You bet.
Okay, cool. Hi, I'm Ben. I'm a natural resources specialist with the Clean Water Division, and I'm here to give you a brief overview of the monitoring and assessment program that we run, which is my main duty as an NRS. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my background, talk about our wadeable stream assessment program, our hydrology monitoring project, illicit discharge detection and elimination, finding problems and fixing problems, low impact development at McCord's Vancouver Toyota, and then our stormwater monitoring efforts, and our new permit requirement, the Lower Columbia Urban Streams Monitoring. So I'm a lifelong Clark County resident. I'm locally educated. I've lived in Vancouver my whole life, and I graduated from Washington State University, Vancouver, with a bachelor's in biology and environmental science. And I got an internship with Clean Water in 2014, and doing much of what I'm doing today, but just, you know, kind of learning the ropes and being compensated very little. And then I got my first full-time job with the county as an environmental code enforcement officer. I regulated mines and quarries throughout the county from 2015 through the end of 2016. That was a very, very challenging job. And then an opening came up for a natural resources specialist, and I got right in there, and I got the job, and I'm very happy. It's my dream job, basically, because I get to go outside all the time. I get to go outside and measure things on the earth, and that's really cool. Mainly water flow, and I measure water quality. So our assessment of wadeable streams, we'll just call it streams assessment. It's pretty clunky title. What we do is we go to our long-term index sites every single month, and we measure water quality there. These sites are spread out through the county. We measure water quality there every month, year after year. This gives us a good idea of water quality trends at these particular sites. You need a lot of data, many years, to be able to decide, okay, is the stream health declining here, or is it getting better? We also have our rotating panel stations that we do with our list sites, our long-term index sites. And these rotating panel sections, we only measure each month for 1 year, and then we move on to a different group. So like last year, we measured a bunch of these sites along Salmon Creek. The year before that, we were kind of in the Lacamas Creek watershed, Shanghai Creek. And then this year, we are in Le Centre and around Washougal. So that gives us a status of those water quality sites.
Then how many sites per year we rotated now?
About 10, 9 to 11.
And will you go through that? Do you go through that panel in the cycle to get status of the same stations over time?
Yeah, so after a 5-year rotation, we'll be back to where we started. So
okay.
And we started that in water year 2017.
Okay.
So you monitor for 1 year and then we'll come back
after 5. After 5, yeah. And so this is just a snapshot, right? We can't, this is a lot of sites. We can't do this. We don't have enough money, staff, and patients to do all that work. So the project goal is we want to describe the status and trends of stream health in the county. We do this by collecting water quality indicators or stream health indicators. And these are measurable parameters. Broadly speaking, water quality, biological conditions, and stream hydrology. We want to put this all in a stream health report. We had the one in 2010. We had to skip 2015 because this program was shut down temporarily. And now we're going to pick it back up and try to do a water quality stream health report in 2020. Oops. I'm going to go the wrong way. So here's a printout from just one sampling event at Cougar Creek. Does anyone know where Cougar Creek is in Hazeldale? Yep. Okay. So this is a number I want you guys to just keep in the back of your minds. 8,400 colony-forming units per 100 milliliters of fecal coliform bacteria. If it sounds high, it's because it is. That's a high number. Why is Cougar Creek so polluted with bacteria? We'll get to that later. So every time we go out, we fill up sample bottles and we send it to an accredited lab for analysis. They do metals, nutrients, fecal coliform bacteria, and now we're actually doing E. coli as well. They do hardness and total solids. And then we have a what's called a YSI Pro DSS water quality sonde, or field meter, or water quality probe, whatever you want to call it. And that measures pH, temperature, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, and conductivity. We take this and we calibrate it in the lab, or in our wet lab, before we go out. We keep a detailed calibration log. We calibrate it with industry standards, so our data is defensible. So once we get all this water quality data in, we want to calculate the OWQI, or the Oregon Water Quality Index. And we do Oregon because we live in the Willamette Valley ecoregion. So we don't have the same, we're not similar to Puget Sound, so we wouldn't use that index. So this takes all those parameters, you put it into an equation, and it spits out a number. And that tells us, is this stream healthy, or is this stream impaired, or is it somewhere in the middle? So it basically just describes general water quality.
Do you also describe the, I actually work for Oregon DEQ,
okay.
In water quality. So and the, using the OWQI, do you do show sub-indices too? You show the individual parameters as well when you report that go into
I'm
the
not
index?
Sure.
Okay.
Because I haven't been a part of the stream
health
report.
So if I may make a suggestion, you want to show the individual parameters that go into the OWQI as well.
Okay.
Because if you're doing really good in most parameters, but you've got one that's really tanked, it'll look okay, but it'll cover what the effect of that is to cover up a problem. So if you're great everywhere, but you've got a major, you know, fecal coliform issue, the OWQI might come out looking pretty good for all water quality parameters taken together.
But it doesn't tell the whole story.
But it's not telling the story that you've got.
Yeah.
Water no one should be swimming in for health reasons.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, so another way we describe stream health is by collecting continuous temperature. Temperature is actually a pollutant, whether you believe it or not. Really high temperatures are bad for some fish. So what we do is we deploy these hobo temperature loggers, we tie them off, secure them to a piece of rebar, We go out to all the sites that I outlined, and long-term index sites and rotating panel sites. We pound them into the stream bed, and we let them sit there for from May to October. And these are programmed to log every 30 minutes, every day, right? Every 30 minutes continuously until October, and that's when the wet season starts. So we use this to calculate whether we are compliant with water bodies of the state. And just so you know, the water quality criteria is 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit for salmon. We often see maximum temperatures exceeding that in some of our streams, 70 degrees or so. We use the 7 DAD max, which is basically a 7-day moving average of maximum temperatures. But just for this presentation, I'm going to keep it simple. We also survey bugs. We use the Benthic Index of Biotic Integrity, or BIBI. We go out each August and September to all those sites, and we survey bugs. So we find representative riffles, and if we can't find those, we do what's called a biological shuffle, where you just kick your feet and move the net back and forth in the water. Hopefully you get a good sample. But if we do find a riffle, we stick the net down in the water, we sit down in the stream bed, we scrub rocks so that the flow of the water is bringing it into the net, and then we composite the sample into a single bottle. Notice we're all gloved up here. This is because we're in Cougar Creek. It's very diluted. And then we send these samples to a professional lab to analyze them and count the various species that they find. Here's a printout. This is from 2016, so it's a little old. The score now, I believe, goes to 100. So this is on a scale of 10 to 50. So you can see Shalachie Creek and Jones Creek. Those have relatively high scores. They have a greater variety of species found. These creeks, Cougar, Curtin, and G, those are more urbanized streams, and they have very low scores. More tolerant species that are able to live in polluted waters. Okay, so another way we can assess water quality is through our hydrology monitoring project. And now this is a separate standalone project that we do. We use the information for our weightable streams assessment project. So we will calculate flow metrics that can tell us how flashy a creek is, whether it's a stormwater dominant or more just groundwater fed streams. We can use this information to verify and calibrate hydrologic models, and we can also use this information for capital and basin planning. So this is me standing in the stream. This is at Jones Creek. It's our pristine Cascade stream outside of the Camas Washougal area. And I'm taking a flow measurement with an acoustic Doppler velocimeter, or ADV, and it calculates the flow with this in-stream measurement. Okay, so a big part of the hydrology project is to maintain these sites, and it's very labor-intensive. There's a lot of sensors and data loggers all over the county that we have to maintain so that we can collect quality data. So first of all, every site needs to be scouted out and verified that it has a gauge pool and a control. So a gauge pool is where the water is nice and still, it kind of slows down, and then downstream of it is a gravel riffle or a natural rock ledge or even a man-made flume or weir that controls the flow leaving the gauge pool. The other big important part is the staff gauge. All measurements we take are tied to the staff gauge. The staff gauge is essentially a ruler that's put into the stream bed above some arbitrary point, right? So this one's at, you can't see it from here, but it's probably like 5 feet of water. But that doesn't mean there's 5 feet of water above the bottom of the stream. That just means there's 5 feet of water above, or that means that the water level is at 5 feet above the bottom of the post where the staff gauge is put in. The other part is the sensor. We use pressure transducers, which sense the amount of water above the sensor. And it's coming down in this pipe right here. And it sits right about there. And so the water level might be 1.5 feet. And the staff gauge might say 4.5 feet. So then those don't line up. So we have to calculate an offset. And we do that through our program, through our data logger. We'll put the 3 feet in for the offset, and then 3 plus 1.5 is 4.5, so now we have a staff gauge and our pressure transducer that match. So we're not actually measuring flow at any of these stations, we're just measuring stage. So then what we have inside of our equipment shelter is a data logger. The data logger takes all the measurements and stores them. We have to program these data loggers using basic language. We have to program these data loggers so that they can communicate with a third-party modem. So I can sit at my office desk and I can communicate to all my stations just from the office. I can check the battery voltage, I can check the stage, water temperature. I can get various error reports from the station. So it's pretty cool. But that's also the most challenging part, is maintaining this telemetry network of modems throughout the county. And they're constantly needing to be upgraded. In fact, last year, they were hacked. And we have tons of people, someone close to one of our modems figured out the password and was able to use our data for whatever they wanted. Or they use our modem to move data, basically. They don't care about our stream gauge sites. But
so they didn't change the data, right?
No. They're just using the modem to transmit their own stuff, and I don't know what it was, but usually we're talking like a few megabytes a month for our stations, and they were running gigs through our modem.
That's crazy.
So these are like, you know, and it turns out that the fix was to update the firmware and software on the modems. And, you know, none of this is taught to you in school. This is all on the job. So maybe we should get universities to have more hands-on classes somehow. And then, of course, power. We run our stations with a big marine battery or several smaller batteries wired together. And we have solar panels at some of our stations. Some of our stations have electricity already, so we just do an AC-DC converter. And that's a big challenge in the winter is scheduling your site visits to when batteries are starting to die. Because once a battery gets below 12 volts, you might lose a whole lot of data because these data loggers will stop operating under 12 volts. So the whole time we're measuring stage, but we want flow. Stage might tell us some cool things about flooding, but we really want to know flow if we want to see what kind of stormwater impacts we might have to some streams. So this is Bob Hutton. He's been with the county for a long time. He comes out in the field and helps me with hydrology sometimes. He's taking a flow measurement across this cross section. This is at Cougar Creek, right on 119th Street. And so we go out every other month and we take a flow measurement. And we record the stage, and then our machine calculates the flow once we're done. So then we put that into our database management software called Aquarius, and we build a rating curve. So these green dots are our most recent measurements. This is at Jones Creek, by the way. These gray dots are older measurements, maybe 3 to 5 years old. And if you notice, those the older measurements don't fall on this line. And that's because the channel is changing, right? We're getting higher stage values with lower flow. So that tells me that the gauge pool is filling in with sediment and gravel, which is totally normal. That's what streams do, they change. So then once we get this rating curve done, so we're constantly updating these, we have to. Once we get this rating curve done, we go back and we back calculate flow. So we run this through a software called Whiteboard, which is part of the Aquarius data management package. And we calculate 15-minute flow. So every stage, we get a flow. And that's very helpful because then we can calculate things like TQ mean, which tells us how flashy a stream is. Cougar Creek, so the lower the fraction, the flashier the stream. So Cougar Creek is about 0.2, at least as of last year. And Jones Creek is 0.4. So Jones Creek, mostly forested. It rains, plants soak up the water, the ground soaks up the water. Cougar Creek is mostly urban, so water hits impervious surface and goes right into it.
That question on Jones Creek, where is the gauge location?
It's upstream of the Camas water intake.
Okay.
On the Jones Creek Road.
The intake on the back of this creek?
No. It's just a small pond on Jones Creek.
Okay. So it's downstream of the state forest land?
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's been a lot of logging because it's surrounded by private land.
Yeah, and the state forests have harvested quite a bit of the state forest acreage in that area as well.
Yeah.
Which is why I asked, because the sedimentation filling in there, I mean, it could just be normal, but it could be with the logging on private lands and potentially even state lands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's an
additional movement there.
There's a buffer around the stream a bit, and I go up there all the time, and I haven't seen any areas where it seems like turbid water is entering, but yeah.
Has there been any ripple, finding of ripples or anything that you've noticed in the areas where you look?
No. Okay, so I'm going to change gears now, because hydrology is my baby and I love it. So that's all just monitoring and assessment, but let's talk about finding problems and fixing problems. Yeah.
Can I ask a question on monitoring? When did the county start this monitoring? How far back did
I think that the weightable streams assessment some version of that since 2002. The rotating panel started in 2006. And then now they've recently been combined together. The hydrology monitoring probably dates back to 2003.
You said that in 2015 there was no report, but is the analysis of those data going to be presented in the 2020 report?
Well, we weren't sampling in 2013, 14, or 15, and we started the sampling again in 2016. So we have 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2020. So there's nothing from 2015.
But you had 2011. 2010, 2011.
Yeah, so 2 years.
2012, so a couple of years.
That's just something we haven't worked out yet, so I don't know.
So what were the years when no sampling was done again?
I believe 2013, 14, and 15.
Okay. And that was just because the program had been defunded, is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so. But I don't know. Do you know?
Yeah. I think Dean talked a little bit about this last time between the economic meltdown, DES, and a number of other things that were going on. I wasn't here.
But there was a lot of things. There was some chaos in the county government, some reorganization going on.
There was significant, and I think there was a move away from some of the testing that the stream health monitored, and so they were doing what was required for the permit. Some of these things aren't necessarily
they were part of the permit, so that was...
Yeah. So the stream assessment isn't permit required.
And that was one of
it's not stormwater permit required.
Right.
Ecology does require.
See, I'm not sure about that.
Because
we weren't doing it for years, so, I mean...
It's not everything water quality is stormwater permit required.
So would it be in the... Their NPDES, their other NPDES permits?
It's in their watershed. It's more from a watershed orientation, watershed management, watershed monitoring requirements.
So not part of the permit?
Not part of a specific permit.
So we'll switch gears and we'll talk about something that is permit required, and that's illicit discharge detection and elimination. This is a really cool program where we actually go out to stormwater outfalls. We have to sample 12% of all the stormwater outfalls or discharge points in Clark County, so in urban areas of unincorporated Clark County. And what we're doing is we're trying to find problems. We're trying to find where someone has put a sewer, you know, a house drain pipe into the storm sewer system for some reason, or there's you know, a spill that we didn't know about that's slowly leaking into our storm sewer system. So what we do is we sample these outfalls. We look to see for odor, stains, and to see if they're flowing. And if they're flowing, we're going to sample it for things like fecal coliform, pH, ammonia, chlorine, surfactants, and these can tell us you know, what is the likely pollutant source. We actually just went out to a site that was referred to us by another Public Works employee, and unfortunately the pipe coming out is not one of our stormwater pipes. And so we're kind of like, what do we do about this? And we tested it, and it had a fecal coliform hit of 3,000 CFUs per 100 mils, which technically we sampled it in the wet season, and that doesn't trigger any kind of action because the threshold is 5,000. But if I went and sampled it right now, since today's May 1st, we're in the dry season, it would trigger further investigation. So the pipe, looking at the pipe, we can see that it's heading up to a house, and we're thinking the pipe daylights right by Whipple Creek, so it's dumping this bacteria-laden water into Whipple Creek, and Whipple Creek already has a ton of bacteria in it. So what we did was we referred it to the health department because we believe that it could be a septic seepage of some sort. So that's just one recent example of what we have found.
As far as who then enforces when illicit discharge is found?
Well, if it's in the MS4, we would. But since this wasn't in the MS4, we referred it to public health, they deal with septic systems.
In your pipes.
Yeah. This is just some old pipe that's just sticking out of the stream bank, and you know, one of our employees found it, and so we went out and sampled it right away, and we got public health on it, and hopefully we can get that pipe blocked, and so that water won't enter the storm sewer or the stream. So when we do find stuff, we follow this flow chart. I don't expect you guys to be able to see anything. It's so difficult to fit this on the screen. So we measure some parameters, and then we follow this flow chart. You know, is it sudsy water? Is it clear water? Does it have an odor? Or is it turbid colors? And these bring us down to logical conclusions like, oh, it's sanitary wastewater, or it's irrigation water, or human waste, stuff like that.
Ben, how was this flowchart put together?
How was it put together?
Yeah. Did the county put it together? Is this something from the Department of Ecology?
This was put together by the county.
Okay.
Based on guidelines from Department of Ecology. And so we're able to use this to find problems and fix problems. And I really think that that's the most important part about clean water is not only do we need to monitor our streams and storm sewer system for pollution, but we also need to stop it. when we find it.
Where are the enforcement bubbles on this chart?
I don't think there are any. Let me look. Nope. No enforcement. So what we would do is we would just contact our code enforcement officer who's with Clean Water. And we, if we had to bring it to that point. Most of the time we're able to get voluntary compliance because we can show them, look, you've got this plunge wrong. You need to fix it. And if not, then we can bring our code enforcement officer in, or we can refer it to the Department of Ecology if it's a really big matter, too. We have that power. The enforcement part is just assumed right there.
What would be the reason to refer to Ecology?
You know, I don't know.
Okay. Fair enough.
But we always have that option. So here's a really cool example. This is Bob Patterson. I don't know if he's talked to you guys yet. He does local source control, and he also assists me with illicit discharge detection elimination. So he was out in the field, and he popped this manhole open, and he noticed that pipe, that doesn't look right. And he looked where the pipe was leading upstream, and it was going to an auto body shop. And this is in Hazeldale on Highway 99.
Yep.
And so he did a local source control inspection, and that's all about finding problems and fixing problems as well. And he got into the shop floor where they do all the work, and he noticed there's floor drains everywhere. He said, you know, let's have you wash this dye down the floor drain, and I want to see if it comes out in this pipe. And sure enough, it did. And so think about what goes on in a shop. We're talking solvents, antifreeze, oil, dirt, grime,
metal
shavings. Yep, not just from them doing work, but breaks. And so this was all. I believe this is in the Cougar Creek watershed. I keep bringing it back to Cougar Creek. It's my favorite polluted stream in the county. And so that's a lot of input into the system. And we were able to find it and block the floor drains. The next step, and we had them do it. Because once people realize that they're polluting, nobody wants to do that, and they want to fix it. 99% of the time, they do. So they fixed it, and you know, we showed them best management practices, such as don't hose it down all the time. You get a spill, put some kitty litter on it, and then sweep it up, or shop vac it up and dump it into the sanitary sewer, so into your sink or your toilet. And so they've really cleaned up their act. This pipe is now blocked, so even if they were to go back to their old practices, at least it wouldn't be going down the floor drain.
And then are sites like that flagged for follow-up?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, we have a pretty extensive local source control program. And I'm actually a part of it. I do so many site visits per year. And yeah, we would flag that for follow-up just to make sure that they're still doing the right thing.
Could that be problematic, discharging it into the sanitary sewer system?
You know, that's a good question.
I can answer that one.
Sure.
So what this we would, because I work for the super district, we require an oil-water separator, so it would catch that stuff before it goes through, and then they have to actually clean the oil-water separators out, just like a grease device.
There could be solvents that don't separate it out.
Yeah, or metals that dissolve as well, and those aren't necessarily, they usually aren't removed by primary and secondary treatment at sewage treatment.
Well, we wouldn't want people to just dump metals into the toilet or anything. But like, for example, mop water or something like that, that should always go to the sink. And that's something that we go over in local source control, right? So we're trying to teach these businesses how to do it the proper way so that they don't discharge to our storm sewer system.
Yeah, in the way that Marie explained it, that is what happens in new developments and everything. They just add the oil water separator and they put it directly to sanitary. So that's usually the standard practice. I guess they were probably doing nothing and just discharging directly to storm. But yeah, usually there's just the oil water separator.
Well, in the old parts of Hazeldell, there's, because it's old, 1950-ish, there was a lot of cross. Contractor would hook up the wrong pipe, and then you don't catch him until Bob does his investigations and he starts putting the dye down. So he caught a lot in Hazeldell.
But if they're solvent,
They shouldn't put solvents
well,
in either
one.
Well,
the solvent should be stored in a waste collection barrel that's protected so it won't spill, that has possibly some secondary containment, like a basin that it sits in. And that would be used solvent would be a hazardous or dangerous waste, so that they would need to become a small quantity generator, which is in their best interest to be a small quantity, because you don't want to be a medium or large quantity generator because of all the regulations. And like shop rags and stuff like that, that's considered dangerous or hazardous waste, and that needs to be stored properly too. So,
is there any particular outreach to businesses that would have generate these kinds of...
Yeah, local source control. We go over all of that. Yeah.
November.
November
is coming.
Yeah, so the concern that I think Sue and I share there is water-soluble pollutants that are going to get right past the water separator, dissolved in wash water or wastewater, that will not be removed by sewage treatment or are going to partition into biosolids, or will go right through in the effluent. Mm-hmm. And so to give you an example, it doesn't apply to auto body shops, but it's immediately on my mind. We have a lot of stuff that comes through in Oregon in sewage treatment, through sewage treatment, where you have both primary and secondary treatment, like pharmaceuticals, for example, and other things that do not get removed by treatment, do not get broken down by treatment, and so they're being discharged into waterways, despite fully functioning sewage treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what Sue and I.
Well, and additionally, if your sanitary sewer is reliant on biological processes, there's things that can be discharged that wipe those processes mm-hmm. out, and it's hard to get those reestablished.
When a tenant comes into the county, they have to come through the sewer district, and we have a form, and one of them is a pretreatment form, that they would have to describe the nature of their business, and then it lists the chemicals that they might possibly use. And even if they don't put anything, but we look to see that it's some industrial, then our pretreatment coordinator will go out and do a site visit, and she works with Bob Patterson quite a bit. So, you try to catch those coming in.
And maybe I made it sound like we want them to just dump everything in the toilets and sink. I'm just talking like mop water or wash water.
The way it came across.
So here's what else we do. We monitor low impact development at the Forest Vancouver Toyota. We just finished up this 8-year-long study where it kind of started up and stopped and started back up again. And we monitored infiltration rates on this permeable parking lot. And these are the areas where water infiltrates, right? On either side of these paver bricks. And I just got to say that these parking lots are awesome. And my suggestion to you guys is you should be promoting this type of low impact development way more than, if you aren't, do it. Because this parking lot, go there and see what type of shape it's in. Yeah, there's some moss that grows in there, but it's in way better shape than any other parking lot I've seen in Clark County. They don't have to asphalt it every 5 years or so. After the big snowstorm a few years ago, when other parking lots had potholes in them and big cracks, this parking lot didn't have any of that. And they didn't need to build a 2-acre detention pond to capture all their stormwater. It just goes into the ground and it stays there. And we know this because we monitor it through this hydrology monitoring flume. This is technically the outfall of the site. So if there was a huge event, that any water that can't fit in the storage area beneath the parking lot, would go into a pipe and then go through this flume, and we can measure that with our hydrology sensing equipment. And we've really measured hardly any runoff. Only one event in 2011 or 2013 produced any measurable runoff, and it was an extremely intense 15-minute downpour. And I can't give you the numbers on that, but really that's it. Virtually 100% of the water infiltrates, and that doesn't matter if there's moss growing there or not. We looked at moss coverage and infiltration rates. This is Bob Hutton again. Pouring water in our infiltrometer, which is basically a bucket with a hole in it. We putty around it so we don't have water leakage. And this is all following the ASTM standards, so we're not just kind of willy-nilly throwing this out there. We're following standard guidelines for this type of work. And what we found is it doesn't matter if there's 100% moss coverage or no moss coverage, this parking lot performs much better than the state ecology standard of 10 inches per hour, I think. Yeah, 10 inches per hour. Even on the high moss areas, it was still 20 inches per hour. So that's a really good thing for business owners who want this type of parking lot. Hey, you don't need to maintain it as much as you might think. And also right now we're doing a moss study at Chuck's Produce, which has a similar parking lot. We want to see, does the moss also pick up metals? Is it a novel stormwater pollutant mitigator, you know, without, you don't even need to spend any money because it just grows there naturally.
So is that the Salmon Creek Chuck's Produce?
Yeah.
Okay. So interestingly, there was a major within the city of Portland air pollution problems at a number of sites that was discovered by Forest Service doing a moss moss study, and the mosses were absorbing heavy metals out of the air, and
yeah,
that's how they were able to discover what were essentially uncontrolled air pollutant discharges at a number of sites in Portland. So I'm given that, I think you're likely to find that the moss will absorb and hold metals, and then the question becomes, how do you dispose of that contaminated moss?
Well, and that's funny because that's where Bob Hutton, who's the project lead, got the idea.
Okay.
he's like, why can't this apply to stormwater too? So
yeah,
it's just a pilot project, you know.
Yeah.
We just did it last Saturday because Chuck's is closed on Saturday, and that parking lot is crazy. And so Saturday there was hardly anyone there. We actually had to stop a street sweeper from sweeping up all the moss. And so that answers your question. Street sweepers sweep it up and then go deposit it like at Watley Pit or somewhere.
Yeah, it's
so
interesting.
I don't know what we do with it. But
we used to work with constructed wetlands that were primarily moss to treat metal-laden water flows. And the difficulty is that after a while, the exchange sites are filled.
Yeah.
And the moss doesn't grow fast enough to take up more. So, you know, so it does saturate. But anyway, there's some documentation.
Well, that's good because then you sweep it up, remove it, and more comes in, and it, maybe it has that ability to take in more pollutants.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We just started this, so it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Are there any requirements or incentives for developers to develop low-impact
I believe it's required to have some component of low-impact development on new buildings and parking lots. My incentive is, like, I don't want to have a detention pond everywhere, or, you know, maintaining these bioretention facilities. No one likes to do that, and this maintenance is driving a sweeper over it. To me, it just makes sense. And actually, you know what, when we were out there, we talked to, I think his name is Curly McCord, or maybe Marv McCord, who's the owner. And he himself told it, I mean, he talked our ear off about how awesome his parking lot is, and one of the best decisions he's ever made as a business person. So I can't believe I don't see it more. It's all over Europe right now. We need to jump on this with all of our parking lots, in my opinion.
Is Mr. McCord willing to function as like an ambassador to the business community? Oh.
I don't know.
Yeah. You know, where are you going to, the question is, where are you going to publish this and where are you going to present this? Because that's really important. I mean, the you know, stormwater management community is very interested and eager to hear more about this, as are the contractors and developers. So.
Testimonial.
And, exactly. And, like the chamber, and data.
Yeah, Clark County Chamber of Commerce would be a great venue for this. Because we're going to get a lot of business owners, you know, paying attention to it.
And it would be a real plus for Clark County to be doing that. PR-wise.
The environmental benefits plus the financial benefits of the ROI of it. They don't have to, you know, repave it every 5 years. That's huge.
Yeah, and the site
and the
reduction
of too.
Labor and materials cost for maintenance as well. Of, you know, this kind of a parking lot versus a parking lot that gets the potholes and so on, plus a detention and you know, infiltration facility as well. So it seems like there's several ways this could be better for business owners.
And there's other ways that you can do this. You don't have to have the pavers. There's permeable concrete and permeable asphalt. I haven't really seen those work very well. There's an example, Urban Red Barn in the Phillida area. The water is supposed to go into the ground when it hits the pavement. And if you drive through there, you can see where water is moving. So, you know, there's stains on the curb of the street where water is moving. So I think that the pavers is the way to go, and then the asphalt and the concrete aren't as effective, especially if you're during construction and you have all these construction vehicles moving in and out and depositing dirt, and they're going to fill up all those spaces that are supposed to be open, pore spaces in the concrete.
But even just blowing dust would fill those open as well, without kind of scrubbing or cleaning mechanism.
I don't know if you know anything more about the other facilities that are associated with Urban Red Barn, but there are LID type facilities beside the road outside of the development. And I watched them being constructed, and the work that was done on them was pretty meticulous. I've never seen any standing water in them at all. Of course, we've been in a drought the last 2 years, so maybe that's it.
Yeah, I haven't looked at them when it's raining. They are pretty, though, and that's kind of the thing with those bioretention facilities, that they can look really pretty, but you have to have that maintenance plan going. Otherwise, they're just going to fill up with invasive species and not function properly.
And they have people there fairly frequently maintaining them. So.
Yeah, that's good. And I know that Kerry Armstrong was here last time. He probably went over all the stormwater facility maintenance issues in the county. So.
Do you know how often they clean or maintain for the Toyota one?
No, I don't. I'm not off the top of my head, but I would assume twice a year. I feel like that's right. So, but
yeah. So I do a lot of work with. I do a lot of development and design and engineering. And a lot of people are just anti-permeable pavers, mostly because they have a bad concept of them, potentially because of other things that aren't working as well, like concrete and asphalt ones. And a lot of it is concern about the amount of maintenance that is put in and the amount of infiltration you still get, depending on how clogged your system is.
Yeah.
It would be interesting if we, if proponents of it, could speak up and say what they've been doing and what they're experiencing and getting from it. And a lot of the people don't go for permeable pavers, mostly because it's either too expensive and they'll have to do both, they don't have good enough filtration. And then I'm just going to add that, everybody is regulated by LAD measures, so if you hit a certain threshold, you have to do something, whether it's permeable or bioretention.
Sorry to stop you from getting through your presentation. I think that the packaging, the permeable surfaces is one, like you're saying, with the asphalt versus the pavers is kind of the problem there. Because my understanding with the pavers is that with the asphalt, the permeable asphalt is a fixed amount of space. So it does clog up, and so you're paying a cheaper installation, but you really have to maintain the maintenance. Whereas the pavers, the mobility of them, so even if stuff grows, the pavers are very minute. As you were mentioning with the thaw, the freezing thaw, that they don't buckle and crack as much because they're actually flexible. Right, there's space. So they're more expensive on the installation, but you buy yourself a little bit more of a maintenance window.
Yeah, but either way, it becomes like a hard sell.
Right.
Everybody's thinking about the ones that get clogged all the time. Well, those get clogged. I mean, you see them, it's not going to work.
Yeah, but the lack of frost heaving and potholing, I mean, right there would really make a huge difference over time. So, I mean, the whole thing is made of expansion joints, essentially.
So, on the Toyota one, is there like a basin that's filled with soil underneath it?
So there's right under the pavers, I believe, is a sand layer. And then underneath that is a gravel sub base. And then we have monitoring wells throughout the parking lot that every month we go out there and we measure water level in, that we can see in the monitoring wells. And then there's a few outfalls that go to a main collection pipe that go to our hydrology station.
Which is the overflow.
Which is the overflow.
So there, but there's no impervious surface beneath the, beneath those layers you're talking about.
Correct. Native
so
soil.
Yeah, infiltrating. Overflow is just what can't be infiltrated rapidly.
Yeah.
It gives it a path.
Yeah.
So far only one storm
since
we've, in the 8 years, has generated any kind of flow. Okay, so the last little bit is our stormwater monitoring program, which we're coming to a close on that. We have only two more storms to capture during the dry season. So starting today, we're monitoring the weather to see if we get any rain coming in. We've sampled hundreds of storms over the last 11 years, and it is a huge undertaking. We have very sophisticated techniques in pacing these storms. We have our own weather service that are able to predict storms. Before we even started sampling, we had to build a rainfall runoff relationship. And we test a ton of parameters, petroleum, hydrocarbons, metals, bacteria, nutrient stability, pesticides, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, tons of stuff. So here's our, I don't expect you guys to be able to see any of this, but these are all the parameters we test, right? And these U's and UJs, these are like non-detects for some of them, right? And then we have our hydrograph here. This is a flow, and this is our rainfall, and these black dots are where we took a sample in our composite sampling machine.
So for how long through the hydrograph do you sample?
We try to sample 75% of the storm, as outlined in the permit, but I would have to actually look at the permit to give you the right number there. So here, you guys might have seen this NAC box on Highway 99.
We saw it on our tour last fall.
Yeah,
oh, okay, great.
Yeah, we saw the outside of it.
Yeah,
okay.
He didn't have the key.
Didn't have the key. This thing is so hard to open, so good luck.
Maybe you have the key, you didn't want to open it.
Yeah, there's some creepy crawlies in here sometimes, so if you're scared of bugs, they just move in, you know? What can we do? So basically, this is our equipment shelter. Here's our rain gauge. This is the box that holds all of our sample bottles for composite sampling. And this is our sampler head. It's an automated sampler. We programmed the sampler to take a aliquot or sample every so many cubic feet of water that passes over a weir. The weir is located underneath the sidewalk. So there's a pipe that goes this way, and then there's a big sump with the weir over it, and so water spills over. And it's calculated so that we can just get instantaneous flow. We don't have to go actually physically measure the flow. So every, let's just say 500 cubic feet of water that flows past this weir, the sampler takes a sample, one aliquot, and we go for 10 aliquots per composite sample. We also go out here and physically take a grab sample to measure petroleum hydrocarbons and fecal coliform bacteria.
That's awesome. I've sampled stuff by hand before. That's awesome.
Yeah, this is really crazy. I came in 2014, and so I started learning about this a few years ago, and it's been a really good experience for me. Inside, we also have a data logger. We have a similar setup to our hydrology stations. It takes a lot of maintenance. And so we collect 11 storms a year. We go for 9 in the wet season, 2 in the dry season. But we've had some really dry seasons, so that's really difficult to do. So this is in the Cougar Creek watershed. In fact, Cougar Creek is just right over here somewhere, and it goes underneath I-5. So everything that goes through this pipe goes directly into Cougar Creek untreated, and the water looks like this. I mean, you don't even need to measure the pollutants in that to know it's polluted, right? Just because it's so turbid, and turbidity is a pollutant. So that alone, I mean, this is, I believe, during the first flush event. So we all know first flush events are super nasty. We've been driving on the concrete. There's an insane amount of bacteria on our streets.
Dog waste.
Feral cats.
Doesn't look like dirt.
What's that?
Doesn't look like dirt turbidity. When you see like
right, it's like a gray and brown.
Yeah, that's tire dust.
Yeah. Metals. Oh yeah. You name it.
Dirt would be an improvement.
So here's an overview map. So this is our site, and it goes down here, and this is Cougar Creek, right? But you're like, that's a stormwater pipe. Well, it's piped underneath Highway 99 and underneath these businesses. And this, I think this is the hotel, maybe not. And then it daylights here for a second before it goes back under I-5. And then it daylights again on the backside of like Marshall's in that Hazelville Marketplace. It's kind of really blown up recently, right? Well, there's dumpsters here right at the edge of Cougar Creek. So I was just there last week looking at these dumpsters for local source control. they looked okay. Their dumpster lids were open. I told them to fix that. But yeah, garbage juice is a pollutant, right? Who knows what's in garbage juice? It's quite disgusting. So all of this water, and this is just a tiny sample of the tens of thousands of gallons that go through this pipe, are going directly into Cougar Creek untreated. And then there's a pipe coming from the south doing the same thing on both sides of the road, and then another pipe from here doing the same thing. And then that's just one street, right? So Cougar Creek runs all through Hazeldale. It's the same story. There's just no treatment. And that's why Cougar Creek's so polluted, in my opinion. That's why we have these high bacteria levels. That's why its TQ mean is so low, because it's stormwater dominated. We get a huge storm that comes over, it dumps all the water, it doesn't go into the ground, it hits the concrete, goes right into the pipes, and it's piped directly into Cougar Creek. And it's pollution by design. We designed this, we did this.
So the only natural segment of Cougar Creek that's down gradient of this is right before it goes into Salmon Creek, right?
From Salmon Creek to this point, actually, it's all stream, like up through Columbia River High School and through the Hazelville. And then from here east, it goes into the Heritage Farm area. And that's actually part of the headwaters of Cougar Creek, is Heritage Farm. And now there's a new apartment complex that they plopped right down there on it, on the other side of 78th. There's the other part of the headwaters. Which I'll have to add, I was a code enforcement officer at the time they were building those, and I was in charge of their monitoring their erosion control at that site, and I got a lot of complaints. So it's really tough because of all this development, and we just need more treatment, in my opinion.
Yeah,
Is there any plans to do any kind of retrofitting or anything that would compel retrofitting?
Yeah, so we, and I'd have to have my my manager talk more about this, but I know that we do stormwater retrofits where we'll take a catch basin, if it's deep enough, and we'll put a media cartridge in, or filter cartridge in the catch basin. So as water goes in, it fills up the cartridge, and then once it gets full, the water slowly meters out while all the sediments are attracted to the media within the cartridge, and then every so often those need to be removed and cleaned. So that's one example. So
that wouldn't be too, is that very expensive or?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So you'd have to manage the cartridges.
Yeah,
it depends.
Yeah, and that would be a public
what you
asset.
Actually get the system for and how big it is and what you're going for exactly. But systems can run anywhere from, well, it depends on what you're doing, but from 10 to 60,000.
Well, I think you could do, instead of having a curve, bump the curb out a little bit, you'd get rid of some street space, but then you could have a bioretention facility along the curb. You could do the media filter cartridges. You could...
There could be a plan.
Well, Suite 99 is really going to be, you know, basically revitalized. And so there's going to be a lot of development. There are going to be a lot of development opportunities along that that this could be sort of built in with.
It's
starting now, yeah. It's going to be happening.
Yeah,
it's
going to be developed.
Right.
Provides opportunities.
Yeah.
It's
right.
The,
so
this year or next year is like primary target. And then after the fire, they're tearing down the entire thing now.
Which is good for.
Stand a chance.
Oh, no, but I'm saying there, I think our manual probably has something about redevelopment, so they have to implement some kind of system to treat the water. So if they weren't doing it before, it's a plus. Now have to treat it in the redevelopment.
One of the challenges is, you know, where is the project boundary relative to redevelopment? And the impact to this stream and to this runoff is not just immediately like adjacent. So it goes out a ways. I don't know how that, but something.
I mean, the problem was built piece by piece, so it can be. You know,
and I think that the 99 corridor was zoned, like being zoned off to different like primary focus areas for redevelopment. So they've got up like north of 99th was one section, and then it was like 99th to 78th, and then 78th down to this is, but it's not numbered now. I don't remember where it is. But there was a big article about it in the beginning of the year about how that was a primary focus for revitalizing that entire region, and they even broke it into several sections. So hopefully that'll go along with some of the, you know, if they are maybe thinking about the bioretention.
Well, the reason why it has to be broken section is because there's a landowner in those pieces that does not want the development, does not care. So then that's probably why you have those, because he's the one that owns that. So you're going to have, there's the Highway 99 business community that they get together weekly, and, you know, they're all for it if you, until this one person gets on board. Or
sounds like another great opportunity for a presentation of some of the results of this and some, like that picture of what it looks like, what the water looks like, et cetera, and what could be done.
Mm-hmm. With the low impact.
Exactly.
Right, right,
exactly.
Yeah.
Especially
that
group
combine
that
with
of
the
Toyota,
businesses. With the Toyota example, and because there was a lot of, in that picture you had up, there's a lot of pavement there, a lot of parking lots, and that's what's going into there. And so if you can, as things are being redeveloped, infiltrate that water instead of piping it, then it, the green versus gray, moving it more towards green.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since several of the businesses that have shut down up there, I mean, besides the huge strip in the up by the church that had the fire at the beginning of the year, and the gas station up there, all of that is being torn down. That's a huge amount of pavement and impermeable surface. And then also just south of that, there's two car dealerships that are in the process, either
one's already shut down, the other one is in the process of it. Those are also huge plots of impermeable surface. So maybe that's a good point with whatever's going in there. The low impact would be fantastic.
So just so you guys know, Justin isn't here tonight, but he is working on a project right now that has triggered, it's a larger project that has triggered a bunch of like upsizing of culverts and everything, with this passage and everything, just by doing the redevelopment. So he's doing a giant site, and then further down he's had to make adjustments and work with the different departments and everything, and this just triggered originally, I think, from LED and from ecology. So don't fear too much. Stuff is definitely happening during redevelopment to help downstream.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear
monitoring
that.
Every stage.
He's in Hazelden? Is the project in Hazelden?
I can't remember that much. I didn't remember him talking about it, so if you hear, you heard that.
And we focus a lot on Hazelden because it's the only real urban area that's not a city. So. Okay, so the last part is our Lower Columbia Urban Streams Monitoring. This is replacing our stormwater permit. So this is a permit required activity. And we are going to be trying to answer the question, are regional conditions in receiving water quality and biota improving in concert with broad implementation of required stormwater management practices? So we're the lead agency, Clark County is. We're going to be doing the monitoring. And then other permittees, City of Vancouver, Cowlitz County, City of Longview, and others are going to be providing the funding. We'll be monitoring similar to our wadeable stream sites. We'll have rotating panel and long-term index sites, which are called legacy sites. We're going to measure stage, conductivity, temperature, habitat, and biological conditions with the option of doing extended parameters if there's funding. So extended parameters would be all, you know, pH, turbidity, dissolved oxygen, and so on. We're measuring stage, but not flow. And so what they want to do is use stage as a surrogate for flow to calculate some of these metrics like TQ mean, so they can see flashiness of a creek. We're just planning this right now. We haven't started monitoring. It's not until next year is when we start our first monitoring. So we're researching new sensors, different ways that we're going to set sites up. We're scouting out sites. Basically, ecology had a computer program that they just randomly generated water quality sites for us. We're going out there and we're finding, oh, well, this doesn't actually exist, or there's no way we can measure anything in this water or in this site because it's dry, stuff like that. So we're currently working through our QAP, and we're going to be sending that to ecology and sort of in the negotiation process of picking sites and deciding what parameters we're going to test. So I don't really have much more on that because we just started it. But it's probably going to be a really cool site with a lot more work for us to do. And I'm not sure how we're going to fit it in, but we have to.
So which jurisdictions are collaborating on this?
Oh, Cowlitz County, City of Longview, I believe the City of Kelso, Vancouver, and Clark County. And I think Washougal and Camas, maybe.
Okay.
I don't have the list with them. Yeah, so we're doing all the work. They're funding us, which is pretty cool. I like more work. And I don't know if we're going to be able to answer this question with what they want us to measure. So that will be interesting.
How many sites?
25 total. So we'll be, in any given year, we'll be monitoring 10 sites. So I think it'll be like 5 legacy sites and 5 rotating panel sites every year. So. that's all I got. Any additional questions?
I know earlier you were talking about monitoring about 12% of the outflow points that you were looking at.
Yeah.
Out of, you know, in an annual cycle, how often would you say you run into a site that really stands out as a fluke signal you've shown from the auto body shop?
A couple. Because a lot of these have already been fixed. And so not as many as we'd hope, or not as many as I'd hope, but maybe that's a good sign because we're testing new outfalls every year. And so we do a bit of a GIS exercise every year and you know, come up with new outfalls to test, or you know, if it's been 5 years, we'll go back to some outfalls that we've already tested. Most of, in my opinion, most of our problems are found through local source control. Yeah. Which that's Bob Patterson. I don't want to step on him right now. So.
And then long term with the future, that's not to work yourselves out of a job, but do you see the ability to set up these monitoring stations where you just basically have an AI system monitoring hundreds of thousands of inputs that could just tell you when something's coming in?
Probably. I wouldn't even know where to start with that, though. So, yeah, I would be out of a job for sure. it's already really complicated as is. And so we're looking for ways to simplify. For, like, our new project, there's this really cool probe. It's made by Solenist, and it's called the LTC. It does water level, temperature, and conductivity, which are the three big parameters that we're going to be testing for our new permit. It's a standalone sensor that you stick down in a pipe into the stream, and you set it and forget it, and then you come every month or every other month and you download data. That sounds nice to me because I've been having a lot of telemetry issues with our sites lately anyway, and to kind of get away from that and simplify things, that's kind of what I'm leaning towards, especially with this new project. Why set up a whole hydrology station with a gauge house and a big, huge staff gauge in the stream when you could just have one little sensor in there, especially if you're only going to measure it for 1 year? So.
Right. I was thinking about that, like, the work is great, but then given the resources spread out over that much territory, it seems like you could have a fair amount of pollution happening, and it takes a pretty long cycle before you might hit it if it's even in your target list. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having monitoring stations on all your major streamways at different points that could radio in, basically, and you could gauge, like, well, somewhere upstream to this point, we've got this type of pollution piece in the long term. So, and that's all resources.
I think that's going to happen in the future, I do. But then you still need someone to go out and calibrate the equipment.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah. No, I hope you still have a job.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. Tracking it all down.
Yeah, it's self-checking data.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Check all the things.
The last thing I was going to say was just as a recommendation. I do a lot of work with the bioremediation, and you guys are mentioning.
Yeah, I remember going to your class.
I knew you were familiar. One of the things that we're looking at a lot with our work, we haven't engaged in piloting it a lot, but I am always trying to pitch the idea up. If you guys do have the opportunity to experiment, is looking at mycorrhizal remediation. So spaces in those parking lots. Now, people always think of funguses as being the fruiting body of the mushrooms, but they can live in the sub layer in there.
Yeah.
So in that space in between, break down a lot of different petrochemicals and
that's cool.
Various things. We're talking about the mosses and the lichens and stuff could absorb. So we've been looking at that with some of the retention facilities and trying to inoculate the soils with mycorrhizal compounds that would break down a lot of the inflow. And
there's very few plants that don't take advantage of that too.
Right. You know, so. And a lot of times when the plants are breaking it down, it's actually the relationship with the mycorrhizal and the root system, so that it's actually the funguses that are doing a lot of
that's cool.
The work on that. So yeah.
Okay.
Push that out there.
Yeah, cool. I'll talk to Bob then.
One other question. Do you any of the flow monitoring that you do or stage monitoring that you do, is it related to flooding at all?
No. Nothing we do is related to flooding. So thankfully, because that would add another layer of responsibility that I just can't handle right now. No. a lot of these creeks are really small, and that's part of the challenge because small creeks change a lot. The Columbia River Am I pointing in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Columbia River doesn't change much. It's basically just a big series of lakes that have flow. These small streams are constantly changing. One big event could bring in a whole lot of gravel and totally wipe out your control or wipe out your station. So,
yeah.
We did observe flooding in February. The G Creek flooded significantly, and there were people sandbagging houses down at the Arnold Park, or I can never remember the name, that really cool park down there. And water was spilling over the road near the wildlife refuge. And so, yeah, there are some areas that flood, but not really on any of our creeks. Thank you.
That is. Thank you. That was great. Good information.
Mm-hmm. And if you guys have any burning questions later on, email me. And if I don't have the answer, I'm really good at saying I don't know, but I can find an answer for you. So,
thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall we start off with our research group?
Yes. So research group was continuing with, you summarized it in a name that I'm not remembering right now, for our project of researching the various groups and organizations in the county that are doing work with relation to clean water. And we have been discussing that a little bit with regard to the scope, you know, what falls within the area of things that we want to cover, and trying to keep the targets manageable so we're actually being effective with our time. So what we've come up with at this point is trying to narrow down a list of questions, so we have a little bit of a script for coming at people with. And now that we have the shared Google Drive, and Michelle ended up putting together a doc that we're using now to come up with a list of folks that we're going to reach out to and starting to assign that. So at the tortoise pace analogy that Dean pointed out last session, we're on course. So we should start being able to make phone calls here real soon and start to get some information together. I think kind of where we're at right now is trying to feel out what our focused objective is going to be, because you can really take off into a lot of directions of questions you want to ask and find yourself trying to solve something that's way too much of an enigma for our amount of time. So I think kind of narrowing the scope of our script's going to be down, and should start to have some information by our next meeting from some folks coming in, but I could definitely see it being a long-term project to compile. Probably an ongoing one. Yeah. Okay.
Anyone
want
to add to that? Nope.
I catch it all.
Okay. Okay. So, outreach, like Eric said, it's been a busy month. It's been a lot of fun. I went to the NACA meeting on the April 8th. That's the Neighborhood Association meeting, for those who don't know the acronym. The WASHDOT could not make it that night. They're going to come to the May meeting. So we had Mike Nichols from Clark County Community Development, who is acting as a problem solver and liaison for the community at different issues. He's fairly new to the program. It's a pilot. He's a very engaging speaker. And right now they're working on the mining issues and the enforcement and the neighbors, and it was very interesting. But he opened it up to the Neighborhood Association presidents that anyone that has some issues, they'll, you know, start a list. So that was...
What was his last name?
It was Mitch Nichols.
Oh, Mitch Nichols, yeah.
And what in particular about the mining issues?
People were concerned about the compliance, the noise, the pollution...
Which,
the roads.
Yeah, which mines? The Livingston Mountain.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah.
Yeah.
But all of them. All, you know, all the local mines that,
yeah,
you know, people don't like living next to when it's their road. So working with the mining staff and getting the trucks and, you know, to comply with the hours that they're supposed to be working and the noise levels and stuff. But it's just a matter of having people sit down and talk about it, you know. And so he seemed very, very open to, you know, being nice and mellow and getting people to open up and sit at the same table. So that's the process that we're working on. And then we had...
Great that they have that position.
So were there people from the gravel companies there?
Not at the NACA meeting, no. He was just letting us know what was going on. Just that he was available to the, you know, the neighborhoods. But he is at those meetings, and if you want to know when the next one is, then, every, you know, it's open. And then we had Greg Peng. He's the director of the Community Home and Health Hospice facility in Salmon Creek. And he was talking about the grief center. And it is open to the public. They have they actually have support groups for all ages. And they have a meditation center for people just to, you know, go through the grieving process. So, and that was pretty much, it's nonprofit, and the funding was just tremendous. They were taking care of this one woman, and she passed away in the hospice portion. And when her husband was so grateful for the care that she was given, he said, I want to make a donation. So they're like, yeah, okay, you know, you can use this and that. And he goes, no, I want to make a donation. And it was $1 million. So they built, if you drive by there, there's a name, and it's a long, I can't remember the name of it, but it's their center. You know, he had it built, so they have a new wing there. And they have, you know, classes and support groups. So that was really interesting. Yeah. And that's what I have for outreach. So we'll go into partnerships.
Partnerships. Well, people have been busy. Justin sent me an email working on his contacts with WDFW related to Fish Passage and potential funding sources beyond technical opportunities. And also in floodplain restoration, looking at the Department of Ecology Floodplains by Design grant program. And he sent an email, and I'll forward this to everybody, and also to Alice and to Dean, to make sure that he's aware of these contacts that are coming up. Sue has met with Ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to write that up and distribute that. And this morning I met with Glenn Lamb of the Columbia Land Trust. And the two areas that seem to have potential overlap and interest are identifying basically recharge areas. So beyond the critical aquifer areas that are associated with just water supply, but into areas that are going to be critical to, or are critical to, supplying flow to the streams and to the various protected habitats. And that includes up into the foothills, so fairly high, and some of the watersheds in East Fork was of particular interest to him. And then the other part for the urbanizing areas was this the Backyard Habitat Program, and how there might be more collaboration with Clark County on that, whether it's funding issue, or how the priority might be increased. So, again, we've talked about that as a program that could have resources and education and training and so forth go on at Heritage Farms. So it sort of rolls back into that other one. And I'll be going to a Heritage Farms meeting tomorrow. The update on that is that they finished the survey. The survey is, one might guess, actually had a lot of people answering who were not necessarily the sort of dominant age group within the within the county. And so within the service area. And so they're trying to balance, and rank what was identified as the highest priorities versus the people that they know are out there, but answered didn't have as many answers. You know, so
that live in the community.
That live in the community, right? But are in the actually in the you know 20 to 40 age group. That's not true. Who didn't have the time, no. Surprisingly, to do the survey. Many of the programs that are going on there now are still being supported. In the recommendations, the watershed and water quality piece and the demonstration parking lot and so forth were featured. That was not mentioned in the survey results. No. That was mentioned, you know, at the NAC meeting that we talked about. He registered it there. So there, and it was also mentioned in a letter to the editor in the Columbian. So, actually two letters. So, Pat's taking the information from a lot of sources. I'm going to be interested in hearing how that rolls up tomorrow night in their work session and making sure that the clean water piece and the clean piece is, you know, front center. So, at least it ends up as a part of the final recommendation. So, that's about it. So we'll be moving forward with our conducts. Oh, I guess the other piece was that the partnership group objective, the objectives, action plan, and so forth, I didn't hear any comments, any suggestions, revisions. So, you know, I'm going to finalize that as the 2019 action plan, post it that way, and also get it into the annual report so that we have that there. Good. Before.
Also, partnerships, I talked a little bit with community and solar ecology, and also talked with the state forest folks for this area at Department of Natural Resources. I've also talked a little bit with Calix Tribe staff as well, just sort of laying groundwork on all those. I think most of us probably in the partnership group did Heritage Farm comments in terms of actually answering the survey and so on. I also went through and looked at the changes being made to the stormwater plan, but didn't comment because there wasn't anything particularly substantive. Like, there wasn't anything that was substantive that was problematic. I've had a couple citizen contacts actually where, you know, a friend of a friend knows them and knows that I'm on this commission, and so those citizen contacts were development related and concerned about impacts of coming development on water quality. So I think that's, if nothing else, you know, I was able to talk with them about what's going on and how processes work and so on. So there was definitely kind of a need for citizens having a way to find out what's going on, how things work, and then just being concerned generally. Also, there's on the subject of quarries, at the request of a local citizen, I was looking into the NPDES permit at the quarry east of Washougal, which had a history of water quality violations and so on, and when it was operating again. And it looked like, and I need to verify this with Ecology, but based on Ecology's website, when I first looked, there was no NPDES permit that was active. It was listed as inactive during the time when operations had restarted, and it was causing a lot of kind of headache in terms of operating hours and noise and truck traffic and safety issues and so on that street. It looked like also during that same time period, the NPDES permit was not active. And later the status on Ecology's website changed to active. And so there are locations identified where stormwater from the site could pollute Givens Creek. And so I'm checking into that to see if this was just a website issue or if that quarry was actually operating without a valid NPDES permit, and somehow that wasn't, the county folks weren't informed of that, I guess. Was there a miscommunication in terms of permit validity and being active, or was there a miscommunication in terms of the permit was not active and the county who regulates the land use wasn't notified that there was no valid permit during operations. So one way or the other, there's a communication issue. So I'm going to track that back to the college.
Thanks, Ted. Are you having any notes from any of your conversations? Or?
I can write them up.
Just so that they can be briefed, just so that we know what's going on.
Yeah, because when we do public outreach, we have a form that we track who we talk to, so it's probably not a bad idea to have some kind of notes and memo whenever you talk to someone as a representative of Clean Water.
People should have a call from the
first person
to indicate if we called them.
What was that?
Just have a call from the first person to indicate if we called them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for something simple. Just
just change the color.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was just color.
So we want to talk about the strategic plan, but we're kind of running out of time. We don't want to keep people too late. What if I do an outline of kind of what I was thinking and send that out for people to look at through Google Docs and maybe make some notes to yourself and, you know, edit suggestions, and we could do it at our next meeting in July.
Yeah, sounds good.
Do you want to have to make a motion on that?
Yeah, we will be sure to know how to use Google Docs and Google Drive.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Because theoretically speaking, so do you have a time where most people are doing this?
There's two different. Because I couldn't ever get either everybody's information when they're available or try to get them together and with the IT guy. So I gave you what he gave me and then also the link. I printed off the link gave you. So there's two different documents there on how to be able to go in and access. The big thing, of course, is to make sure that you use the Google Docs that has the Clark County logo in the upper right-hand corner. And the other thing is, because this is a business account, there's a little bit more security than on the other one, so it's not. But the only thing that I've seen that's different is, and it's kind of nice, is if you get into a document, the easiest thing is just download it, and then you can use it in Word, and then you re-upload it back in, or use it in Excel. You don't have to use it in the Google format. So, and then it goes back up and saves and you can see it. One of the things I actually ran into as a tip, don't do what I did. I thought I was the only one using the Google Docs account, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'll just use the last one for the annual report, for the 2019 annual report. You know, I'm you know, the last person, of course, who's ever edited it in the last recently. Yeah, no, Michelle has been putting things in. So I had to go back and re-enter all my stuff because she used it after I had. So actually go into the file that's, you know, the 2019 documents and go into that file. Don't do the one you used last. Because there's a shortcut across the top, you know, files you used last. So that was something I did. You should have it. If you have any questions, let me know. I can walk it through. I can do a demonstration or spend some time with you, or I can get the IT guy. There's a big push in the county right now to go Windows 10, have everything and everybody switched over to Windows 10 by June. So the IT department is going kind of crazy, plus also WorkDesk. So.
What fun was that?
Yeah. So I mean, originally the goal was by the end of the year, but then they've been told you will have it done by June. So they are really, really, really focused on that. There's some other things that they're working on too. So,
so if we download a file, make some edits, say we do track changes. Mm-hmm. So when we upload it, the track changes will be uploaded.
Yes, because I played.
Do you want us to use any kind of naming formula for you know, that this is the most current file or what, you know, the,
because it'll show
like
the
my
date.
Initials.
If you want to do your
that
stuff,
that I've done something to it, or
it'll show the date, or it shows, like, I think there's 3 or 4 different ones in there, and then I was playing with it a little bit to see. I will play with it again and see if there. Because when I went in and looked, it went in and it updated the one that was already there. So when I uploaded it back, it didn't make a separate one.
So if we upload the file that we've been in and put our initials on the end of it, then you'll
know there'll be two. Well, then there'll be two.
You'll know whether.
Well, yeah, there'll be two of them there.
So there will be two there, but one will have initials, and it'll be more current. And then somebody else can grab the most recent one with anybody's initials, put their add theirs to it, whatever. I mean, that's one.
That
kind of
defeats the purpose, because then you end up having two different.
Yeah, it's okay. But I think when you put the new one in, if it's the same name, it would just replace
yeah,
the old
one. Yeah, it'll
just
replace
the old one. So it shouldn't be an issue.
It's only if you wanted to keep the old one clean and pristine, and we can call that, you know, the original, don't touch this one. And then have our draft one that everybody can edit off of.
As long as everybody does track changes, that works.
Yes.
But if people don't do track changes, then you don't know whether something's changed in it or not.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you're going in and editing a document, do track changes.
And then it seems that someone has like the final decider on what gets in of all the edits that happen.
Yeah, it's whoever you guys make those decisions.
The document, I think.
And then, I mean, because I'll go in, or whoever is the owner. I think technically I'm the manager, so I'm the IT guy. So I can go in and master do it. But also whoever uploaded the original can obviously do it. So there's a couple of different ways to handle it. But after, you know, decisions are made with your body, making those decisions of what you want to have, then we can go in and update it, and then we can name it final. And then it's done. And then you have your draft version that has all of the edits and all of everything there. We have our original clean, our edits, and then we have our final. We can rename it new after everything's been accepted, what you want, and name it final. So then it's very open for everybody to be able to see what the process was with that. So, but if you have any issues, let me know. But I've been playing with these, and you can see where I've done my little red check marks and my underlines, and so I was actually using these, and if there was any little tricks or anything like that, so you'll see on there. And then there was a second one, it was that link that I had sent out from our learning center. So I think that's it.
The draft changes have just been in Word that you guys were behind, right? So
yeah.
I think I can try to spell it.
No, because you're inputting that information into a repository for the information. I don't think that's as critical for.
Yeah, I'm fine.
And even then, it I have on mine, and I'd be kind of interested to see with you guys. It lists out who on my history. It shows off to the side the thing who's been into what document and who's changed what. And there's a list going down the side.
You can do that with the Excel. We do that with our timesheet program at work.
Oh, really?
So if anybody messes anything up, we can figure out who did it.
Oh.
But it doesn't show you. You just have to go into the report, and then you can like find out who did what at what time.
Yeah. And then it also has it in Google Docs of who's been into what files, so that's that. So great. Thanks. So quick things for me. So I've been working with IT on that. And then Workday is still a huge challenge. We're slowly getting there. Just been so many business processes that have changed, and going from the 1980s DOS version to modern web app-based version has been huge. At the beginning, basically the fiscal year, and then basically shutting off all financial aspects for a month. It's been a lot, and so we're getting there, but it's still, there's a lot there, just a lot of processes that have changed, and you know, just even internal billing for, you know, departments getting billed for gas and things like that. Everything's been different and changed. Public Works has a drone, and we're going to be using it for various projects. One that was highlighted at our big department-wide safety meeting in March was this winter. We had a case where a roadway became seriously undermined super fast. Was it 99th Street? I don't know. But anyway, it happened really fast, and it completely ate away underneath the roadway, and it was not safe for people to go in underneath that area. And it did collapse a couple hours in. And so they actually sent the little drone in there, and we have three drone drivers that are, you know, they've been certified by the FAA, and they are going to be going in and being able to use it for a number of different public works projects. And we have our staff meeting tomorrow, and they're going to show us how to use it and what they're going to do, some of the cool things that they're planning with that. I'm in the process of doing the style guide makeover for the stormwater management plan. Look what I did with the annual report, so we're working on that, and so next year's will look different a lot more. Public Works is in the process of hiring. I think they're in the interview process for most of these positions. The Public Works Assistant Director, they're still in the process of that, as well as the Director's Assistant. There's a financial person, and then also Jeff Mize, the position, the Community Media Relations person for Public Works. Those are some of the key positions that we're in the process right now of hiring for. Dean's been involved in a lot of those. Just finished our spring supplementary budget decision packages. I think they were due this week or last, but really soon. Taxes were due yesterday, so Andrea has been fielding a lot of phone calls regarding their people's clean water fees. So we call it 427, wanting to get, like, well, they close in 3 minutes. So that was one of the things. And then finally, talking about July. In January, you guys said you wanted to have your meeting. Are you sure you really, really, really want to have it on July 3rd? The night before the 4th of July, which I was looking at our calendar in our office, and most people are taking that Wednesday off, or they are wanting to leave because a lot of people are making it into a long weekend. Is that something you want to do? The 10th is available. I can get this straight for the 10th if you want, and I can publish things out. I just don't know what people's plans are. If you're around and you want to do it, great. But realistically, are we going to have a quorum?
Can we show a hands people who are in town?
On the 3rd?
On the 3rd?
Justin and I are both not.
I'm in town for
the 3rd.
You're not here? Probably not. And I'm like, gone on the
10th. So let's do the 10th then.
Okay. I may be gone on the 10th.
Oh, you're gone on the 10th?
Yeah. So I basically have every other week available to me for summer vacations because of my responsibilities for the East County Fire and Rescue Commission, as a commissioner there. And that's first and third Tuesdays, so I may be traveling, doing family vacation on the 10th, so the 3rd works better for me.
Okay.
So there's three people out on the 3rd, and who can't make the 10th? Josh?
Mm-hmm.
The 10th might be tough for me. I can make the 3rd, I don't know which way you count it.
I'm kind of split, so what do you think then?
So then you wouldn't ask me.
Well, I'm leaving on the 4th. I stayed in town for the 3rd because I knew we had a meeting.
Last weekend in June?
Yeah, we'll do that a week before.
Yeah.
I think we're going for like week split.
Yeah, what about the
week
before?
I don't know if we can change dates.
I did not look.
Is everyone free?
The 26th sounds good.
Let me see if I can access this from this computer. And I can get my email if I want to install. I can look and see whether the availability is for the rooms. So the other option, the other thing I wanted to get from you while this is loading is, what is, thank you very much.
What would be your preference? I was not going to schedule, looking at who we have available. This is going to take me a long time. I don't know what that's trying to do. I'll have to look and see what is available. See if there's the training round and watch. It looks like it is open. So if you would like to do the 26th, we can move that up.
Does that work for everybody? Are you in the same situation with that?
Well, that's the one, but I won't be able to physically be here. But I can call in, no problem.
Does that put you in the same situation with the...
It's supposed to be in the same situation.
Yeah.
Trying to coordinate summer travel and kids' schedules across two households.
We can leave it, and if we have a quorum or we don't, we can do that. I just wanted to...
So we leave in at July 3rd?
Leave it on the 3rd?
I can leave it there.
Okay. I can see if I can try to call in.
Okay.
And then my other question is, do you want to have a speaker? We've had off to the side now for several months since I was hired. The Conservation District, you had wanted to have the Conservation District come in and give a presentation, or do you want to wait since you're probably talking with them, or have it be a really short meeting? I've just had this on here forever, and I didn't know. I just keep kicking it out a couple more months, because we've got other things going on.
No, we just September. Yeah, there'll be more people in September.
So I just didn't know if you still wanted to have them come and give a presentation, or if you wanted...
What's the
presentation? It's the...
Conservation
district.
Basically, I think it's life after the most recent decision on conservation district funding or lack thereof and so forth.
At this point, exactly.
Because I think it was something that you had asked, the board had asked for, the commission had asked for them to come talk to you back in probably September, right before your meeting, before the funding. So
the relevancy of it may be less important a year later. So
they were at the Earth Day. They had a booth.
I think it would be still worthwhile. I mean, it's not a question that's going to go away.
Yeah, I don't think it wouldn't be worthwhile.
And they're still a partner.
If we were going to coordinate a speaker, though, I don't know if that's something we can do by email in the meantime, figuring that out.
I was newly elected to the Conservation District Board of Supervisors, and I haven't been sworn in yet, but I know they're going to be talking at their next, they meet the first Thursday morning of every month, and they're going to be talking about their budgeting and plans for next year, so maybe in a couple of months would be good, and then they can talk about how things look for the next year. So I think they got some additional money from the state, and I think have been able to cobble things together to enable them to have three part-time people. So they're still providing services, and it didn't turn out to be as dire as it would. But the long term is really the question.
Mm-hmm. So you can cue us as to when would be the best time.
Sure, and I'll talk to them too, let them know that you're interested in hearing their status.
Okay.
Do you have a presentation lined up for September?
I was, since the new permit will come effective in August, we should get the new one, I was planning on trying to have Rod Swanson come in and talk about the permit, or have Bob Patterson, Global Source Control, come in and talk about that. So if Rod is not available, or we don't have a good plan because of just getting it in August, we'll have it be, I'll have him talk in November, and then have Bob talk in September. If not, my plan right now is to have Rod talk about the permit
In September.
No. Yeah.
And then timeline.
Yeah, and then have Bob Patterson talk about local social control in November.
And well, it could be maybe we could have two speakers at one meeting and know that maybe the conservation district is a shorter one.
We could also have a special meeting, like in October, and have Rod talk.
The other thing is that we could, since we didn't, often when people come and present, we've got a lot of questions, a lot of points of discussion amongst ourselves and triggers. Maybe we just focus on the strategic plan in July and not worry about
the presenter. That's what I was thinking.
And then there was another thing. Marie and I were talking about the biochar connection and the, would there be interest as a medium for restoration planting facilities in having a biochar representative present here about the research and applicant potential uses at some point? You might put that on your list, Allison.
Sure. Are you looking for somebody? Yeah.
I've got some names.
Some names, okay.
You know, but if you have somebody you're already working with, that you think is good.
I do. He's a pretty colorful individual.
That's good.
Colorful individual. Yeah, he's a very good speaker.
That sounds good.
He's so converted to it that it's hard to know where
want
the science and the religion blur.
Maybe not. Let me see who I can get.
Okay. So July, well, I'll send the outline out, and the people that can't be here at least provide your input, and we can just maybe do some. We have a whiteboard, maybe do some whiteboarding and do some brainstorming on the plan and goals and vision. And I have some things I talked to Dean about where he wants us to kind of follow, so we'll do that next time.
They have cell phone service in Burns, but I'm not sure how far out of Burns I'm going to be.
Yeah. We'll be on the plane. Oh, okay. Going somewhere fun?
It's in Arizona.
Okay. Anything else to discuss?
As much as I want to get out the door, I didn't want to bother Ben's presentation with this, but he was talking about the stream report, and I don't know who in here took a chance to look at that, but I know one of the things that I thought was interesting that I wanted to make a comment to the group on, that if you look at that, it was interesting to me how many areas they would give a watershed a general grade and say, okay, well, this stream is fair, or this watershed area is, good, let's say. But you'd look at the data and you'd look at over this whole thing broken up into sections, they did a couple of tests right here and the tests only came back with this information and it got a good score based on those couple of tests of the information there. My geographical understanding of the county looking at some of those maps was like, well, you're missing a huge chunk of that watershed's assessment. So I know a lot of work went into that report, but I thought it was kind of interesting that it's a funded and a lot of hours went into it to basically say, yeah, we think this is the general health of the county stream. And I can tell looking at it with my background that you could change a lot of those colors in that. There was many of them that got a good grade that I would be surprised if you had full data for that watershed based on those parameters, it would still come into the good category. And, I don't want to say anything against the work that people are doing on the whole thing, but I think I was slightly disappointed that it sometimes is able to look at it and say, our health's good in this watershed, and I highly doubt it based on the information I've seen.
You only hit a point every 5 years.
Yeah, there's a limitation to the funding and stuff, but I think that if you're going to end up doing, if you're giving yourself a grade for the health in your area, that you got to also explain the curve on what you're grading yourself. Because there was several of those areas, but one in particular that I know is a lot of the watersheds with Lacamas Creek area, and there were some spots where it was we've tested up here and that came out pretty good, so it's given it a good score, and I'm like, that's not an accurate picture of what that watershed looks like by the time it enters the Washougal River. So
good locations. when I read it. But yeah, I'm looking at different.
Well, I guess kind of like your excellent, good,
it,
fair.
I'm like, oh my God, I can't go anywhere. And
it's, well, yeah, it's not great.
Yeah.
And your only real good ones are going to be primarily the Washougal and the North Fork. And I don't even know if the East Fork gave. So I thought those were excellent. And then in my mind, what I'm thinking is like excellent green, good yellow, and then like kind of fair and poor. But if you were breaking it down on that scale, I was thinking that like it generally tried to give the county a like slightly above average.
Oh, I'm sure that we need much more.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. But I, when I look it up, everything's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's the audience for the report and what's going to be gained by it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, if the audience is the public that's using the waterways or the elected officials that are making decisions about those waterways, then it should probably accurately reflect the state of those waterways.
Well, except that if you can't really do that because you'd have to break it down into sub-watersheds, et cetera, to really, you know, do that, and you don't have the resources to. Do you caveat it in the introduction?
I think you have to directly discuss the data limitations that for the size of the area we're talking about and the density of streams. There is very little information. If that were being assessed for, you know, the 305B report under the Clean Water Act, that would be just, you would have a bunch of Category 3 there, insufficient data to make a statement. And that's, I think, needs to be the primary part of it, is that there is insufficient data to make a statement. You can identify that some sites are polluted and some look okay, but, you know the polluted ones are definitely polluted because you verified that, but there's a lot of, what statistically you would call type 2 error. There's a whole lot of, it's pretty easy to say things are fine, and that's just because you don't have enough information to find the problems.
Well, and I do feel...
You were describing, but
yeah.
I think being explicit about that, but there are major data limitations here, and we could be missing lots of problems, and we have no way of knowing that.
And I think that's kind of where it was for me, because it wasn't that I was looking at the grading and saying, I disagree with that. I wasn't looking at the data and saying, I disagree with the data.
Yeah.
Like, what I was seeing lacking was being presented when you read it thoroughly. You're like, oh, yeah, there's all this not data missing.
Yeah.
But then they would say, this watershed's good.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that watershed's hardly... That's hardly accurate enough to say, and I thought that was the part was the
no,
color coding to me, right?
It's north of a development, or north of,
yeah. There'd be color coded green, yellow, or red, and I was like, it'd probably be colored gray because you don't actually have enough information to give it.
So there's a 2020 report coming up. It's in the works.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we'll get a chance to
hopefully more
draft form.
Mm-hmm. Well,
take
it might be good for us to all
take
a look at the old one and have some input just based on that, and they may be planning to do a different
thing. Maybe that's another thing we do for July.
If we can just give some feedback based on the old one, what we see was lacking there.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Did
they say when we're going to put it up?
He said 2020.
Oh, it is in 2020.
Or
Well, and I think that's really the origin of it for me, is that I'm not coming at it so much from a point of feeling that someone's trying to pull a quick one or that there is, some ulterior motive to it. I think it's just like, to me, if you're able to say, we don't have enough resources to actually collect the data to tell you what the health of the watershed is, then that's better than the public thinking or the elected officials who don't have time to thoroughly read or just see like, okay, great, good.
Or the experience.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
There's 3 years of no data.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's better to say we actually don't have enough information to accurately record that for you to make a decision, to make an educated opinion on.
I'm wondering if they're able to do that based on whatever they're
asked to do.
So they might not be able to put that in their report.
Yeah.
But if you saw like his points for the, was it the,
or maybe they would lose the,
or if it's a new
stage,
new grant funding,
you know, yeah, when you're missing
he mentioned they were trying to select sites right now for the next cycle of the project. So if, you know, we're seeing there's gaps in the locations on these waterways where they currently have the monitoring systems, if they're going to put new ones in, then those sites should be more reflective of the whole health of the water system, not just a small portion.
But I think for the permanent ones, we need the permanent ones
there. Right, right.
I think that's what was happening.
Yeah, leave those, because they said the legacy ones, so if they're going to leave those there, then they have the, if they have the resources to add new ones, identify more of the gaps.
Right, but I think it's a good look at the old report.
And that's something else, they're still developing that, the Lower Columbia work. So I think maybe we'll see the discussion on that in July, because that would be a good place for us to, because it sounds like they're not going to actually increase the number of rotating panel sites and for a year or a total number of sites basis, and so that does not correct this insufficient geographic reach problem that they've already got.
And if they have more funding because they have more people involved,
right,
maybe they have more resources to get some students out there to do the sampling.
And that monitoring will inform whether or not the current management practices are sufficient. So.
Right. So without sufficient sample density across space
and time, we could assume everything is
then you're running into type 2 error.
Yeah.
You didn't detect problems because your chance of actually detecting the problems that exist are important. It was unlikely you would see anything, no matter how bad it is.
Well, I was involved in a little bit of the planning that went on for the Lower Columbia River stuff.
Yeah.
And part of the difficulty was that they went through a couple of years, really, in the planning process with ecology and to design the thing. And when they finally sort of agreed on the parameters and the locations, that kind of stuff, or how many and that kind of stuff, then they put some costs to it, estimates to it, which were really low, low-ball estimates, but it was like, oh yeah, okay, we can do this, but it got shaved from there, is what happened. So there's funding, but, you know, it wasn't enough to do the ideal, and so it's so I think actually on that basis I think that's part of the rationale for making the caveats and the qualifiers in the introduction. And what is it useful for, how much can you save from
anything else?
Right.
Okay, so hearing no other business, the meeting is adjourned at 9:03.
Going for a record.
I know.